Hi, everyone, and welcome to this reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. This is the Wednesday, October 5th edition, as brought to you here on the morning of October the 6th, Thursday. Hope you're having a great start to your day, everyone. This is Andrew Hopp, your reader, filling in. And before we take a check of the headlines, we will go ahead and take a look at our weather and forecast here for the next couple of days. And starting off with today, you can expect much cooler conditions from yesterday, where we saw a high of right around 68 degrees, actually closer maybe to 65 degrees or so yesterday. The low is expected to be around 51 degrees overnight. But for today, though, a high of just 59 degrees. Winds from the north up to 25 miles per hour in partly cloudy conditions. For tonight, much colder, a low of 34 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, expect a high of just 51 degrees. And then Friday night into Saturday morning, a low of 28 degrees. Burr, definitely in the freeze condition out there as we're getting closer here, everyone. We're definitely in the fall season. Saturday, though, warmer, a high of 61 degrees. Sunday, high 69, so it'll be a nice weekend out and about. You can go out and enjoy some sunshine on Saturday, it looks like, and then mostly sunny conditions on Sunday. But again, for today, your Thursday, expect partly cloudy conditions, much cooler, winds out of the north up to 25 miles per hour, high 59 degrees. As we take a check of the headlines here, hearing delayed for Plaza shooter, judge not available for Tuesday's sentencing. Also, the headline photo here shows fields of opportunity, organic food demand rising, but number of U.S. growers falling. And then district approves rec program, Mason City students will have access to outdoor activities. That's a story by Abby Koch. Well, starting it off now with fields of opportunity, the headline story. It's actually an AP story here. Organic food demand rising, but number of U.S. growers falling. And the photo shows George Naylor looking over his organic apples grown on his farm September 13th near Sherdan, Iowa. And he's there holding those apples there in his hand. They look really good, very red. It's written by Scott McFetridge of the AP. Dateline Sherdan. In the 1970s, when George Naylor said he wanted to grow organic crops, the idea didn't go over well. Back then, organic crops were an oddity, destined for health food stores or maybe a few farmers' markets. I told my dad I wanted to be an organic farmer, and he goes, "Ha, ha, ha," Naylor said, noting it wasn't until 2014 that he could embrace his dream and begin transitioning from standard to organic crops. But over the decades, something unexpected happened. Demand for organics started increasing so fast that it began outstripping the supply produced in the U.S. Now a new challenge has emerged. It's not getting consumers to pay the higher prices. It's convincing enough farmers to get past their organic reluctance and start taking advantage of the revenue pouring in. Instead of growing to meet the demand, the number of farmers converting to organic is actually dropping. Last month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture committed up to $300 million to recruit and help more farmers make the switch. It feels good, said Chris Schreiner, executive director of the organic certifying organization Oregon TILTH, T-I-L-T-H, referring to the government help. It's a milestone in the arc of this work. Schreiner, who has worked at the Oregon-based organization since 1998, said expanding technical training is important given the vast differences in farming land conventionally and organically. Schreiner noted that one farmer told him that converting a conventional farmer was like asking a foot doctor to become a heart surgeon. The key difference is the use of synthetic fertilizers and pesticides as well as genetically modified seeds. Most conventional farms rely on those practices, but they are banned at organic farms. Instead, organic farmers must control weeds and pests with techniques such as rotating different crops and planting cover crops that squeeze out weeds and add nutrients to the soil. Crops can only be deemed organic if they are grown on land that hasn't been treated with synthetic substances for 3 years. During that period, farmers can grow crops, but they won't get the extra premium that accompanies organic crops. According to the USDA, the number of conventional farms newly transitioning to organic production dropped by about 70% from 2008 to 2019. Organic comprises about 6% of overall food sales, but only 1% of the country's farmland is in organic production, with foreign producers making up the gap. In the U.S., there are so many barriers to farmers making that leap to organic, said Megan D. Bates, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Organic Trade Association. While farmers seem hesitant, U.S. consumers aren't. Annual sales of organic products have roughly doubled in the past decade and now top $63 billion, according to the Organic Trade Association. Sales are projected to climb to 5.5% this year. That growth is clear to anyone pushing a cart in the average supermarket, past bins of organic apples and bananas, through dairy and egg sections, and along shelves brimming with organic beef and chicken. The new USDA effort would include $100 million towards helping farmers learn new techniques for growing organic crops, $75 million for farmers who meet new conservation practice standards, $25 million to expand crop insurance options and reduce costs, and $100 million to aid organic supply chains and develop markets for organics. Nick Andrews, an Oregon State University Extension agent who works with organic farmers, called the USDA effort a game changer. It should be especially attractive to farmers with small parcels of land because the added value of organic crops makes it possible to make significant money off even 25 to 100-acre farms, much smaller than the commercial operations that provide most of the country's produce. I've seen organic farmers keep families in business who otherwise would go out of business, Andrews said. Noah Wendt, who in the past few years transitioned 1,500 acres of land in central Iowa to organic, noted the shift has been rocky at times for him and his farming partner, Caleb Aiken. But he and Aiken recently bought a grain elevator east of Des Moines to use solely for organic crops, the kind of project the USDA program can assist. They hope the elevator will not only be a nearby spot to store grain, but provide a one-stop shop to learn about growing and marketing organic crops. Seeing all the organic activity is gratifying for George and Patty Naylor, who farm near the tiny central Iowa community of Sherdan. They say they still value most the simple benefits of their choice, such as evenings spent watching hundreds of rare monarch butterflies that flock to their herbicide-free farm. As Patty Naylor put it, it really helps to believe in what you're doing. Right, in other news, from the front page, hearing delayed for Plaza shooter, judge not available for Tuesday's sentencing. This written by Matthew Rezab and Lisa Gruet of the Globe Gazette. The story goes on, a sentencing hearing for a Chicago man who shot and killed a man in Mason City on the Federal Plaza in October 2021 has been delayed. The hearing for 26-year-old Jelani Armon Falk, originally scheduled for Tuesday in Cerro Gordo District Court, was continued because the judge assigned to the case was unavailable to preside over the matter at that time. The hearing had not been rescheduled as of Tuesday afternoon. As part of the plea agreement, Falk admits he shot and killed 35-year-old Christopher Tucker in the early morning hours of October 3, 2021. Falk was originally charged with first-degree murder, but ultimately pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter as a repeat offender, interference with official acts while displaying a firearm as a repeat offender, and possession of a firearm as a felon as a repeat offender. The prosecution and defense are recommending 15-year prison sentences on each count. Each count has a mandatory minimum sentence of 3 years. Falk may be ordered by the judge to serve the sentences consecutively or concurrently. Mason City Police Officer Noah Fries was in the area of the Federal Plaza at the time when he heard shots fired and ran to the scene, according to a press release issued by the Mason City Police Department. Upon arriving at the scene on State Street, Fries saw several people running toward him and ordered them to the ground. Falk did not comply and instead raised a weapon at Fries, according to court documents. Fries shot Falk several times, injuring him. Falk was taken to Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center for treatment. A review of the incident by the State Department of Criminal Investigation, DCI, found Freese was justified in the shooting, a finding backed up by Winnebago County Attorney Kelsey Beanken, who reviewed the incident at the request of Cerro Gordo County Attorney Carlisle Dalen. The judge on the case at the time, Rustin Davenport, later ordered both findings removed from the DCI and local law enforcement websites after Falk's attorney argued in a motion that details in those reports were inaccurate and could bias a potential jury. All right, more things going on in the area. After that, district approves rec program is our final front page story. Mason City students will have access to outdoor activities. It's written by Abby Koch of the Globe Gazette. Mason City students will have the opportunity to participate in a range of outdoor recreational activities. A memorandum of understanding with Wayne's Ski and Cycle was approved by the Mason City School Board during a special meeting Monday. The partnership provides access to outdoor recreation and instruction. The high school physical education program is trying to do lifetime fitness, the idea of being fit throughout life, said Superintendent Pat Hamilton. Services and equipment from Wayne's Ski and Cycle will be available to students who are enrolled in the Outdoor Pursuits class. Students now have the opportunity to learn how to snowshoe, cross-country ski, and bike. Wayne's Ski and Cycle will provide the bicycles, helmets, snowshoes, and cross-country skis, pending availability, for students to use. The store will provide training on how to properly care for and use the equipment for teachers and students, according to the memorandum. Mason City Community School District will be in charge of storing and maintaining all equipment used in the class. Any equipment that is lost or stolen will be the district's responsibility. The school district will pay Wayne's Ski and Cycle a one-time payment of $30,000 for the equipment use and training during the 2022-23 school year. That's this year. Funding for the equipment is not coming from general funds, but from Title IV, which is known as the Well-Rounded Education Funds, according to Hamilton. Title IV, four in Roman numerals, funds guidelines enable school districts to sign agreements with outside entities to provide student training and equipment for well-rounded educational opportunities, said Hamilton via email Tuesday. Hamilton added that at the end of the equipment's lifetime, there may be options for the district to purchase. That written by Abby Koch, who covers entertainment and education for the Globe Gazette. That story there. And that was our final front page story. Moving on to news here on page A2. Mason City neighborhood cleans things up. In the headline photo shows a big dumpster in what looks to be the street or near someone's front yard. And the caption reads, Georgia Hanford Neighborhood Association. Georgia Hanford Neighborhood Association member Mark Dempsey stands on top of one of the fully loaded dumpsters during the 15th annual cleanup day. And the photo, it's in black and white, is by Mary Loden of the Globe Gazette, who also wrote this story. And it begins. The Georgia Hanford Neighborhood Association held its 15th annual Cleanup Day Saturday. For a small donation or the regular North Iowa landfill fee for appliances, neighboring residents could get rid of unwanted items. It gives residents the opportunity to clean out their homes, yards, and garages and save time and money by not having to haul items to the landfill themselves or renting garbage containers. For those who need assistance, Cleanup Day volunteers are willing to pick up garbage the night before. The Georgia Hanford neighborhood consists of around 270 homes in the area from Georgia Hanford Park, located on 23rd Street North to 19th Street Southeast, and from South Federal Avenue East to South Carolina Place. The idea was born out of resident Chris Watts' walks through his neighborhood. He saw trash and unwanted items in backyards and alleys and knew a large share of neighborhood residents were elderly folks who needed assistance. He got together with two of his neighbors, Mark Dempsey and Larry Solberg, and they formed the Neighborhood Association. The men, along with their wives, took flyers to each home and encouraged their neighbors to bring stuff to the park. Dempsey said they usually fill two large roll-off containers and sometimes a third with just household rubbish. In addition to that, They fill a flat rack with appliances and another with scrap metal. We get a chunk of money back, and that offsets our costs, Solberg said. After everything is paid, the remainder of the donations go back into the park and the maintenance and upkeep of the lilac hedges on 19th Street. To get the project off the ground, Watts applied for a neighborhood grant from the city, but the effort didn't stop there. Watts also asked businesses for donations and wrote grant applications to raise enough money for new playground equipment. Association members and volunteers assembled and installed the equipment themselves. In the years since the Georgia Hanford Neighborhood Association's first cleanup day, enough funds have been raised for fencing, pouring cement for a regulation basketball court, benches, and a dual headlight pole that shines on the playground equipment, and the shelter house, which cuts down on vandalism. Right, a few briefs here in the news on page A2 of the Mason City Globe-Gazette. Mason City man accused with attack with barbed wire bat. Ugh. A man is in jail after allegedly breaking into a Mason City residence wearing what appeared to be a bloody mask, carrying a baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire in the early morning hours of September 25th. According to court records, 33-year-old Keith James Ingersoll has been charged with first-degree burglary, possession of explosive or weapon. The crime is a Class B felony punishable by up to 25 years in prison. The affidavit states that Ingersoll broke into a residence in the 600 block of 6th Street Northwest at 12:32 a.m. carrying the bat. He allegedly swung the bat multiple times at two individuals present inside. The affidavit does not state the type of face mask Ingersoll was wearing. No injuries were reported, and it is unclear if property was damaged. A warrant was issued for Ingersoll's arrest on September 27th, and he was arrested by Mason City Police on Tuesday. He is being held on $25,000 bond at the Cerro Gordo County Jail. No preliminary hearing has been scheduled as of Tuesday afternoon. Next up, city treating for weeds on October 5th. City of Mason City will be treating weeds at Central Park dependent upon weather conditions. Weed treatments and fertilizing Central Park is scheduled to take place on Wednesday, October 5th. Residents are asked to avoid all the flagged areas for 24 hours after the treatment until treatment flags are removed, according to the press release. Material safety data sheets, or MSDS, for the product to be applied are available in the city administrator's office on the first floor of City Hall. And then also here in the briefs, Artoberfest returns to McNider. McNider Art Museum has announced the return of Artoberfest this year. The 21 and older event will be from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Friday, October 21st. Tickets are $50 and are for sale on the museum's website and at Mormon Clothiers, Hy-Vee East, Hy-Vee West, and at the museum. The fundraiser will feature a variety of brews from all over the Midwest and an assortment of food. Guests will receive two drink tickets with more available for purchase at the event. Enjoy live music by the Hats as you enjoy a drink. More than 80 silent auction items have been donated from local businesses and artists. The live auction will return this year, which includes dinners, artwork, and one-of-a-kind experiences. This is an excellent opportunity for community members to support the McNider Art Museum in a fun way. If individuals are interested in volunteering or donating, please call 641-421-3666. The museum will be closed Friday, October 21st, and Saturday, October 22nd, for Artoberfest preparation and cleanup. And that story by Abby Koch, who covers education and entertainment for the Globe-Gazette. In other news here on page A2, The Onion and the Supreme Court, not a parody. That's written by Mark Sherman of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. The Onion has some serious things to say in defense of parody. The satirical site that manages to persuade people to believe the absurd has filed a Supreme Court brief in support of a man who was prosecuted for making fun of police on social media. As the Globe's premier parodists, The Onion's writers also have a self-serving interest in preventing political authorities from imprisoning humorists, lawyers for The Onion wrote in a brief filed Monday. This brief is submitted in the interest of at least mitigating their future punishment. The court filing doesn't entirely keep a straight face, calling the federal judiciary total Latin dorks. and I'll try to say this with a straight face. The Onion said it employs 350,000 people, is read by 4.3 trillion people, and has, quote-unquote, grown into the single most powerful and influential organization in human history, end quote. The Supreme Court case involves Anthony Novak, who was arrested after he spoofed the Parma, Ohio police force on Facebook. His posts were published over 12 hours and included an announcement of new police hiring, strongly encouraging minorities to not apply. Another post promoted a fake event in which child sex offenders could be removed from the sex offender registry and accepted as honorary police officer. After being acquitted of criminal charges, the man sued the police for violating his constitutional rights. But a federal appeals court ruled officers have qualified immunity and threw out the lawsuit. One issue is whether people might reasonably have believed that what they saw on Novak's site was real. But the Onion said Novak had no obligation to post a disclaimer. Put simply, for parody to work, it has to plausibly mimic the original, the Onion said, noting its own tendency to mimic the dry tone of an Associated Press news story. People have republished the Onion's claims as true, including when it reported in 2012 that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was the sexiest man alive. The brief concludes with a familiar call for the court to hear the case and a twist. The petition for certiorari should be granted, the rights of the people vindicated, and various historical wrongs remedied. The Onion would welcome any one of the three, particularly the first, the Onion lawyers wrote. Okay. On that unique note, we move on to page A3 now in the North Iowa Spotlight, looking at the fall colors around Mason City. Perhaps you can take a copy of The Onion with you when you do. And this is all a photo essay, and I'll try to describe some of these briefly for you. And they are around the town, and including here at Willow Creek near McNider Woods, just off the North Pierce Avenue in Mason City. And it shows the trees. They are changing. There are yellows, oranges, and still some green in the trees over the river over Willow Creek here. Photo by Lisa Gruet. Another photo shows, and these are in color, the small hiking trail in McNider Woods just off North Pierce Avenue in Mason City with leaves on the ground and the trees are changing above. And then there is Big Black near Lester Milligan Park in Mason City. In the foreground is water, and in the background is, and kind of along the banks here that kind of wraps around, the bank does, to get into the background. The trees are multiple colors, including a little red, orange, yellow, and still some green left. Quite a scene. And then one more photo. Actually, there's three more photos here. Another photo shows Big Blue at Lester Milligan Park in Mason City. And there's a lot of red in those leaves, with leaves in the foreground on the banks of Big Blue. And then another photo shows Lester Milligan Park in Mason City. More colors there with the pond or lake in the background. And then the final photo shows a view from the Meredith Wilson footbridge in Mason City facing west. And there's much more green in the trees in this photo. And still some red, but a lot more yellow, about an equal portion of yellow and green. So fall is here. It's changing. The colors are down here, starting pretty good here in central Iowa. So enjoy it while it lasts. Moving on now to page A4, the Nation and World section here of the Mason City Globe Gazette. We start off with a digest section. Charges tossed in Flint water crisis. A Michigan judge threw out felony charges Tuesday against seven people in the Flint water scandal, including two former state health officials blamed for Legionnaires' disease deaths. The dismissal was significant, but not a complete surprise after the Michigan Supreme Court in June said a different judge acting as a one-person grand jury had no authority to issue indictments. Judge Elizabeth Kelly rejected efforts by the Attorney General's office to send the cases to Flint District Court and turn them into criminal complaints, a typical path to filing felony charges in Michigan. Kelly's decision doesn't affect former Republican Governor Rick Snyder, as he was charged with two misdemeanors, willful neglect of duty, and his case is being handled by another judge. But he, too, was indicted in a process declared invalid by the Supreme Court. His next hearing is October 26th. In other news, White House keeps focus on abortion. in Washington, where Joe Biden is trying to keep the issue of abortion front and center ahead of the midterm elections when Democrats hope to keep control of Congress. Biden and Kamala Harris gathered cabinet secretaries and other top administration officials Tuesday, 100 days after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, to meet with doctors who already have seen problems with miscarriage care and pregnancy loss. Most abortions are banned in at least 14 states. Two steps were announced Tuesday. The Education Department will remind universities that federal law requires them to protect their students from discrimination on basis of pregnancy, including pregnancy termination, said the Department of Health and Human Services, that they will promote family planning services with $6 million in new funding. All right. And then moving on to the voting rights issue in the briefs. The Supreme Court heard 2 hours of arguments Tuesday in an Alabama redistricting case that could have far-reaching effects on minority voting power across the U.S. and seemed likely to divide the court along ideological lines. From there we go to railroad deal. A fourth union, the American Train Dispatchers Association, said Tuesday that 64% of its roughly 1,600 members approved the deal made with major freight railroads last month to prevent a strike and secure 24% raises and $5,000 in bonuses for workers. Wow. January 6th probe, Arizona Republican Party Chair Kelly Ward refused to answer questions pleading her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination during a deposition of the White House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, an attorney for the panel revealed Tuesday during a court hearing in Phoenix. And then North Korea, Joe Biden spoke Tuesday with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida to discuss next steps after North Korea conducted its longest ever test launch by firing a nuclear-capable ballistic missile over Japan. Job openings is the heading of this next little section here. The number of available jobs in the U.S. plummeted in August compared with July as businesses grew less desperate for workers. That is good news for Federal Reserve efforts to bring down inflation without causing a recession. The jobs report released Tuesday also showed layoffs remained historically low. And then finally, Iran protests. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi appealed for national unity Tuesday, even as anti-government protests continued to spread. Raisi acknowledged the Islamic Republic has weakness and shortcomings, but repeated that the unrest sparked by the death of a woman in custody of the country's morality police was a plot by Iran's enemies. And we are just short of the halfway point here. That leaves us time for one more story, talking about the Mar-a-Lago raid. Trump appeals to court. Ex-president's lawyers try to put the brakes on FBI's investigation. This written by Eric Tucker of the AP and Dateline Washington, where lawyers for President Donald Trump asked the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday to step into the legal fight over the classified documents seized during an FBI search of his Florida estate, escalating a dispute over the powers of an independent arbiter appointed to inspect the records. The Trump team asked the justices to overturn a lower court ruling and allow the arbiter, called a special master, to review the roughly 100 documents with classification markings that were taken in the August 8th search of Mar-a-Lago. A three-judge panel from the Atlanta-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit last month limited the special master's review to the much larger tranche of non-classified documents. The judges, including two Trump appointees, sided with the Justice Department, which argued there was no legal basis for the special master to conduct his own review of the classified records. But Trump's lawyers said in their application to the Supreme Court that it was essential for the special master to have access to the classified records to determine whether documents bearing classification markings are in fact classified, and regardless of classification, whether those records are personal records or presidential records. The FBI says it seized roughly 11,000 documents, including about 100 with classification markings, during its search. The Trump team asked a judge in Florida, Aileen Cannon, to appoint a special master to do an independent review of the records. Cannon assigned veteran Brooklyn Judge Raymond Deary to review the records and segregate those that may be protected by claims of attorney-client privilege and executive privilege. She also barred the FBI from being able to use the classified documents as part of its criminal investigation. The Justice Department appealed, prompting the 11th Circuit to lift Cannon's hold on investigators' ability to scrutinize the classified records. The appeals court also ruled that the department did not have to provide Deary with access to the classified records. Trump's lawyers submitted the Supreme Court application to Justice Clarence Thomas, who oversees emergency matters from Florida and several other southern states. Thomas can act on his own or, as is usually done, refer the emergency appeal to the rest of the court. Thomas came under scrutiny for his vote in a different Trump documents case in which he was the only member of the court to vote against allowing the U.S. House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot to obtain Trump records held by the National Archives and Records Administration. And we're at that time. We're at the halfway point here in this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. All material heard here on IRIS is intended solely for the use of our listeners. I'm your reader today, filling in. My name is Andrew Haupt. If you have any questions on this or any other IRIS program, then please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. And we have two, as well as two death notices. The first were Nancy Jo Clifford, who passed away October 2nd. A celebration of life will be held from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, October the 8th, 2022, at the Rock Falls Community Center at 3 Nottingham Street in Rock Falls, Iowa. The family invites you to come and enjoy drinks and memories on Nancy, of Nancy, I think is what they mean. Guests are encouraged to wear casual attire. The Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City is in charge of arrangements. They can be reached at 641-423-2372. And then we also have Jane K. Padelty, who passed away September 29th. Jane K. Padelty, age 84, of Bloomington, Minnesota, passed away September 29th, 2022. Jane had a passion for music and was a talented organist and accompanist. Preceded in death by husband Holmes, brothers Richard and Arlen Duesenberg, survived by children Lori Padelty, Kevin married to Joan, and Mark married to Karen Miksch, six grandchildren and sister-in-law Eunice Duesenberg. Family service and interment at Elmwood Cemetery in Mason City, Iowa. If so desired, memorials may be directed to magnumcorum.org/make-a-gift/. The Gill Brothers Funeral Directors are in charge of arrangements. Can be reached at 612-861-6088. And then two death notices here on page A5 as well. The first for Kenneth Fred Feckers, age 63, of Clarksville, died Monday, October 3rd at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Arrangements are with the Council Woodley Funeral Home of Green. And then also Ronald L. Smith, age 78 of Mason City, died on Monday, October 3rd, 2022 at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice Inpatient Unit. Arrangements are with the Major Erickson Funeral Home. All right, and then talking about a lady who just passed away on Tuesday, that would be the coal miner's daughter, Miss Loretta Lynn. Absolutely beautiful and tremendous voice in country music, and one of her fans is talking to you right now. She passed away at the age of 90. This is written by Kristen M. Hall of the Associated Press here on A5, page A5 of the Mason City Globe Gazette. Dateline Nashville, Tennessee. Loretta Lynn, the Kentucky coal miner's daughter, whose frank songs about life and love as a woman in Appalachia pulled her out of poverty and made her a pillar of country music, has died. She was 90. In a statement provided to the Associated Press, Lynn's family said she died Tuesday at her home in Hurricane Mills, Tennessee. Our precious mom, Loretta Lynn, passed away peacefully this morning, October 4th, in her sleep at home in her beloved ranch in Hurricane Mills, the family said in a statement. They asked for privacy as they grieve and said a memorial will be announced later. Lynn already had four children before launching her career in the early 1960s, and her songs reflected her pride in her rural Kentucky background. As a songwriter, she crafted a persona of a defiantly tough woman a contrast to the stereotypical image of most female country singers. The Country Music Hall of Famer wrote fearlessly about sex and love, cheating husbands, divorce, and birth control, and sometimes got in trouble with radio programmers for material from which even rock performers once shied away. Her biggest hits came in the 1960s and 70s, including Coal Miner's Daughter, You Ain't Woman Enough, The Pill, Don't Come Home Drinkin' with Lovin' on Your Mind, Rated X, and You're Looking at Country. She was known for appearing in floor-length wide gowns with elaborate embroidery or rhinestones, many created by her longtime personal assistant and designer, Tim Cobb. And the photo shows her here in... she's actually at the... it looks like she's at the Ryman. I could be wrong, but she's in like a church-type pew, but that appears to be the Ryman. Country singer Loretta Lynn, she's posing in the portrait by Christopher Berkey of the AP. This is from September of 2000 in Nashville. The Kentucky coal miner's daughter, who became a pillar of country music, died Tuesday, reads the caption. Another short story here on page A5, Smacked Asteroid Has Long Debris Trail. Very short here. This is written by Marcia Dunn of the AP, Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. The asteroid that got smacked by a NASA spacecraft is now being trailed by thousands of miles of debris from the impact. Astronomers captured the scene millions of miles away with a telescope in Chile. Their remarkable observation 2 days after last month's planetary defense test was recently released by a National Science Foundation lab in Arizona. Well, with that being read and said, we're moving on now to the sports section. We're looking at a few things here. But Iowa Wrestling is the headline. Focus on March for Lee's return to the mat. This is written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times, but airing here in the Mason City Globe Gazette. Tom Brands is as excited as anyone to see Spencer Lee return to the mat and resume his chase of becoming the first Iowa wrestler ever to win 4 NCAA championships. But the Hawkeye coach said Monday during an appearance at the Davenport Grid Club that Lee will work toward being ready in March, not November. Spencer's been awesome, Brand said. He's working to take the steps that he needs to take to put him in a good place in March. That's what I'm excited about, seeing Spencer out there in March. Between now and then, Brand said it is important for Lee to maintain a measured approach about his return to competition as he works his way back after undergoing surgery earlier this year to repair anterior cruciate ligament. I hope I'm saying that right. Cruciate, spelled C-R-U-C-I-A-T-E, ligament injuries to both of his knees. He won't be on the mat every time out. That just wouldn't be smart, Brand said. We'll put together a plan that is smart and one that will prepare him. One of 7 3-time NCAA champions in Iowa history, the 125-pound Lee hasn't wrestled for Iowa, extending a winning streak to 38 matches with a 6-1 decision over Jacob Camacho of North Carolina State in the Red Division finals of the collegiate wrestling duels last season on December 21st. The two-time Hodge Trophy winner announced on New Year's Day that he would sit out the remainder of the 2021-22 season and undergo surgery to repair his ACL injuries, the first suffered in 2019 at the NCAA Championships and the second during the Big Ten Championships in 2021. He's coming along and he'll be healthier, a healthier competitor when he's back out there, Brand said. We still have to figure some things out team-wise, how it will all work, but it will be good to have him back. One of the most dominant collegiate wrestlers of the past decade, Lee enters his senior season with a 78-5 career record, and 29 of those wins have ended in the first period, including 21 matches won by fall. During his ongoing 38-match win streak, Lee has outsourced his opponents 463-41. Lee's return will come at a time when the Hawkeyes will be looking to rebound from a rough finish to the 2021-22 season. The Hawkeyes finished third at the Big Ten Championships behind Michigan and Penn State and also took third 2 weeks later at the NCAA Championships. While Iowa won a team trophy at the NCAA Finals rather, for the 13th time in 14 years, the Hawkeyes expected more. "We have to own it," Brand said. "But we aren't sprinting to March. We have to be diligent, we have to be disciplined, and we have to be patient. There isn't a race to November. It's about being ready when we need to be ready. That's what really matters. Well, Lee will join three 2022 All-Americans in competing for lineup spots for Iowa this season. Jacob Warner, the NCAA runner-up at 197 pounds, Tony Cassiope at 285, and Stanford transfer Real Woods at 141 all bring that level of success to the Hawkeye roster. And another front page news, talking about Iowa football, disappointed but not surprised, Ferentz appreciative of Hawkeye support as of coaches as new trend takes over. And the photo here shows Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz and receiver Arland Bruce IV questioning a penalty during the second half of Saturday's game at Kinnick Stadium. This is written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times, Dateline Iowa City. 10 years ago, it would have been shocking. Today, the in-season dismissal of two colleagues is just another indication of how college football has changed from the perspective of the Dean of College Football Coaches, Iowa's Kirk Ferentz. The 24th-year Hawkeye coach said Tuesday during his weekly news conference that he wasn't surprised when he learned of Sunday's firing of Wisconsin coach Paul Christ or the dismissal earlier this season of Nebraska coach Scott Frost. Disappointed but not surprised, Ferentz said. I think Christ is the fifth one this season, right? The toll has mounted. Ball kind of got rolling last year. The one big one I remember was USC the second week of the year. My question would be, if it's that bad, why didn't you do it a year ago or a half year ago? Ferentz said the firings in the Big Ten, as well as those of Jeff Collins at Georgia Tech, Herm Edwards at Arizona State, and Carl Dorrell at Colorado, are simply a sign of the times. That's the world we're living in right now, Ferentz said. Beyond understanding that a Wisconsin program Christ coached to a 67-26 record was off to a slow 2-3 start this season, Ferentz said he really remains on the outside looking in as defensive coordinator Jim Leonhard becomes the Badgers' interim head coach. You think about the success they've had, but again, I'm not privy to all the details, Ferentz said. I'm not there, so I can't comment on any one specific situation. You never know what's going on behind the scenes. Well, Ferentz compared the in-season coaching decisions to the Big Ten, expanding to include USC and UCLA in the conference beginning in 2024. We're living in different times now, operating in a different world, and we live in a very reactionary world too right now. That's obvious, Ferentz said. We are basically in the entertainment industry now, and some things come with that. That's kind of what we're seeing. In some ways, we're becoming a little bit more like the NFL. While the speed and timing of when decisions are made has changed, Ferentz said, one thing has not changed over time. It's a results-driven business, and it's always has been, Ferentz said. With the ouster of Christ and Frost from their collegiate alma maters, three Big Ten programs in states bordering Iowa have made coaching changes within the past 2 years, including Illinois' hiring of Brett Bielema, or Bielema, B-I-E-L-E-M-A, a year ago to lead a team that carries a 4-1 record into Saturday's 6:30 p.m. game against the Hawkeyes. Ferentz said he doesn't take for granted the stability that has been a part of the program at Iowa, where the football program has been led by just two coaches since 1979, Hayden Fry for 20 seasons and Ferentz for the past 24. In the 20 years prior to Fry's arrival, Iowa had churned through five coaches. I've been lucky in my career to be places where people have been pretty reasonable and they understand competition and help you work through things. To me, there's only two ways to do it if you hit adversity. Just trash the thing and then start over, or you try to work through it, Ferentz said. For whatever reason, it's kind of worked out, and I'm appreciative of that. I've always been appreciative of working in a good, stable environment. Don't take it for granted. Ferentz said he understands that things have changed in his profession, calling it reflective of the times. He added he would be naive not to understand that. To me, philosophically, the challenge is more like if you're in a competitive endeavor, you understand that it's tough. It's tough to be successful and tough to be at the top, Ferentz said. When you're not, you focus on solutions and working through things rather than just throwing bodies out and trying again with another. There's a million teams that have tried that over the last 50 years, and not many of them have had a lot of luck getting traction. Well, Iowa items, Roberts progresses. Starting cornerback Terry Roberts, who played only a handful of downs in Iowa's game against Michigan after missing the Big Ten opener at Rutgers, is getting closer to full speed. He was pretty limited last week and didn't play much in the game, Ferentz said. He's having a better week of practice, so that's encouraging. Hopefully we'll get him back this week, and that will help our depth a little bit in the back end. Ferentz does not expect defensive tackle Yaya Black or receiver Deontay Vines to be back against the Fighting Illini. Still in play, Iowa players spent a lot of time talking Tuesday about how their goals of repeating as Big Ten West Division champions remain in play. Winning the division, getting to Indy, that is still all in front of us, defensive tackle Noah Shannon said. It's up to us to take care of business. In a division where six teams are 1-1 in league play and the seventh is winless in two games, the Hawkeyes are the only team that has not played another division opponent yet. That changes Saturday. Tickets plentiful. While all remaining Iowa home games are sold out, tickets remain plentiful for Saturday's game at Illinois. And the photo here also shows, and this is on page B2, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz is in the photo congratulating defensive back Kayvon Merriweather after scoring a touchdown against Rutgers during the first half Saturday night. It was Iowa's first fumble recovery for a touchdown since Jack Campbell last year at Iowa State. And the photo is by Noah K. Murray of the Associated Press. And in the photo, he looks like he's got his left hand on top of Merriweather's number 26 helmet there. And one of the players in the background is smiling and laughing. Moving on now to Iowa State football. Brock Norton uncertain for the weekend. Cyclones two top running backs questionable with injuries ahead of number 20 Kansas State. That's written by Rob Gray, special to the Globe Gazette. Dateline Ames, Iowa, where Jarrell Brock knew something was off with his ankle. Iowa State's top tailback had absorbed a hit while running for 8 yards in his one and only carry early in Saturday's 14-11 loss at number 21 Kansas, but still wanted to try to play. Brock couldn't, though, and his status, along with his primary backup, Cartavius Norton's, remains fully up in the air as the Cyclones have a 3-2 overall record and 0-2 in the Big 12 prepare for Saturday's 6:30 p.m. matchup with number 20 Kansas State at Jack Trice Stadium. Where are those guys at? ISU head coach Matt Campbell said during Tuesday's weekly news conference. I think we'll know a lot more as we get on the practice field Tuesday and Wednesday. We would certainly love to have any of those guys available for us, and I think those guys are closer than farther away. Well, how close? Official word likely won't be known until kickoff against the Wildcats with a 4-1 overall record and a 2-0 record in the conference, which have struggled to stop the run so far this season. Kansas State ranks 71st nationally in rushing defense with 143.8 yards per game, but the Cyclones' rushing offense ranks 111th among 130 FBS teams, averaging 112 yards per game. So if Brock and or Norton are unable to play, ISU carries will fall primarily to Deion Silas and Eli Sanders, who averaged 3.8 and 3.2 yards per carry, respectively, so far this season. Next man up, Silas said about becoming the primary ball carrier after Brock's first quarter injury. Silas, a shifty 5'8", 200-pound sophomore, has rushed for 2 touchdowns this season, which matches Brock's scoring output on the ground. But Brock leads the team with 306 yards rushing while averaging 5.6 yards per carry. His absence adversely impacted Saturday's loss to the Jayhawks as the Cyclones managed to net just 26 yards rushing on 30 carries. That being said, we certainly have belief in the rest of our running backs in our football program, said Campbell, whose team has won 3 of the past 4 meetings with the Wildcats. And I thought those guys did some positive things for us in the game on Saturday, he said. One of the reasons Campbell cited for meager rushing numbers this season is, quote-unquote, flow of the game. Case in point, in each of ISU's Big 12 season opening losses, Baylor and Kansas surged to early double-digit leads. That forced the Cyclones to prioritize the passing game while trying to play catch-up, diminishing the effectiveness of the offense's second dimension. "You're trying to get yourself back into the football game a little bit," Campbell said, "so I think the flow kind of goes against the grain of where we need to play and where we would want to play." That, of course, would be playing from ahead instead of constantly trying to claw back from behind. And both Silas and Sanders did provide some glimpses of what they're capable of against the Jayhawks. Silas notched a 12-yard run, and Sanders fought for 7 yards on one carry, and each caught at least one pass from quarterback Hunter Deckers in the loss. "Every snap counts," said Silas, who averaged 5.8 yards per carry in limited duty last season while rushing for 2 touchdowns. "So just really take advantage of every rep." All right, that takes care of our sports section for today. Not a lot of local news in there as far as Mason City is concerned. So we'll just go ahead and move along back to some more news here in the A section. Talking about Florida and the hurricane, Hurricane Ian, the photo here on page A4 shows residents behind a "You Loot, We Shoot" sign cleaning up their flooded property Tuesday in Northport, Florida. And that's kind of messy there. Looks like they're cleaning some stuff out of that house. And one guy is there with his arm on the car door or SUV door. CUV, I think is what you call it. It's a Chevy Traverse, I believe. And he's looking kind of off. And he's looks like kind of a person that's like, "Don't mess with me." Anyway, that's the photo there. There's a German Shepherd in the foreground as well. Might not want to mess with these people. Florida endures wait for power, reads the headline. Subheadline, meanwhile, rescuers uncover more deaths in wake of hurricane. That's written by Rebecca Santana of the Associated Press. Dateline, Bonita Springs, Florida, where Hurricane Ian may be gone, long gone from Florida, but workers on the ground were pushing ahead Tuesday to restore power and search for anyone still trapped inside flooded or damaged homes. The number of storm-related deaths grew to at least 80 in recent days, both because of the dangers posed by cleaning up and as search and rescue crews combed through the hardest-hit areas. Officials said that as of Monday, more than 2,350 people had been rescued throughout the state. At least 71 people were killed in Florida, 5 in North Carolina, 3 in Cuba, and 1 in Virginia since Ian made landfall on the Caribbean island September 27th. After churning northeastward into the Atlantic, the hurricane made another landfall in South Carolina before pushing into the mid-Atlantic states. There have been deaths in vehicle wrecks, drownings, and accidents. A man drowned after becoming trapped under a vehicle. Another got trapped trying to climb through a window. A woman died when a gust of wind knocked her off her porch while she was smoking a cigarette as the storm approached, authorities said. In hardest-hit Lee County, Florida, all 45 people killed by the hurricane were over age 50. As floodwaters begin to recede, power restoration has become job one. Ian knocked out power to 2.6 million customers across Florida after it roared ashore with 150-mile-per-hour winds and a powerful storm surge. State officials said they expect power to be restored by Sunday to customers whose power lines and other electric infrastructure is still intact. About 400,000 homes and businesses in Florida were still without power Tuesday. Eric Siligi, chairman and CEO of Florida Power and Light, the largest power provider in the state, said he understands the frustration and that 21,000 utility workers from 30 states are working as hard as they can to restore power as quickly as possible. The utility expects to have power restored to 95% of its service areas by the end of the day Friday, he said. The remaining 5% are mostly special situations where it's difficult to restore electricity. Elsewhere, the hurricane's remnants, now a nor'easter, were not done with the United States. Heavy rain fell Tuesday from Philadelphia to Boston, though not enough to cause flooding. The storm's onshore winds are causing some minor ocean flooding at high tide from the North Carolina Outer Banks to Long Island, New York. And one more short story here. Musk agrees to buy social media platform. The Tesla CEO offers to end wrangling is back to the original $44 billion price. That's written by Tom Kreischer, Barbara Artute, Randall Chase, and Matt O'Brien of the Associated Press. The tumultuous saga of Elon Musk's on-again, off-again purchase of Twitter took a turn toward a conclusion Tuesday after the mercurial Tesla CEO proposed to buy the company at the originally agreed-on price of $44 billion. Musk made the surprising turnaround not on Twitter, as has been his custom, but in a letter to Twitter that the company disclosed in a filing Tuesday with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. It came less than 2 weeks before a trial between the two parties is scheduled to start in Delaware. In response, Twitter said it intends to close the transaction at $54.20 per share after receiving the letter from Musk, but the company stopped short of saying it will drop its lawsuit against the billionaire Tesla CEO. Experts said that makes sense given the contentious relationship and lack of trust between the two parties. I don't think Twitter will give up its trial date on just Musk's word. It's going to need more certainty about closing, said Andrew Jennings, a professor at Brooklyn Law School, noting that the company may also be worried about Musk's proposal being a delay tactic. He already tried to unsuccessfully postpone the trial twice. Twitter's stock resumed trading late Tuesday and soared 22% to close at $52 even. And with that being read and said, this brings us to the conclusion of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for this October 5th edition, brought to you right now on the morning of October 6th, Thursday. We appreciate your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. This has been your reader, Andrew Haupt, filling in. Live reading of the Des Moines Register is next, hour number one, so keep it set. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Have a great day and straight ahead.